Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This is a special episode of the Here and Now podcast. I'm Tanya Mosley. That's two award-winning writers and scholars, Jesse Holland and John Jennings. Jennings is founder and director of a new line of graphic novels by and for people of color called Megascope. And Jesse Holland is the editor of Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda, the story of the Holland family farm in Mississippi told and represent, part of the DC Comics Heritage series. Here's my extended conversation with them. It's so exciting to have you both together. Why don't we start with why comics have become your passion and profession? Some folks who aren't in this world don't even understand how intense and dynamic this world is. I'll start with you, John.
So I've always been I can't remember a time when I wasn't a comics fan. You know, that's the first thing. Like I was a super early reader. And my mother introduced me to comics very young. I think the first comics I remember reading are like, you know, the Mighty Thor and like Spider-Man and, you know, Daredevil was my favorite superhero, you know, stuff like that. And it was because I was such an avid reader that she wanted to keep me reading and stuff. But little did she know that she was creating like an obsession and, you know, going into, you know, various aspects of my career right now. And I don't know, I think as a medium, because that's the other thing too, there's a conflation in our country between genre and medium. Because the superhero genre is so dominant, we tend to not see the fact that you can tell any kind of story with comics. And they are a different type of reading because they merge sequence, the visuality of a film, but also like textual information at the same time. So they're very multimodal. And as a media professor, I've become really interested in that aspect. And it's just a really difficult, beautiful, unrelenting, like wonderful medium to work in. And I think that's why I've been so fascinated by it. And it's just really immediate and it speaks in, you know, in the symbolic way that a lot of media can't, you know? So yeah, that's my just out the box, you know, answer for that to start with. So
Jesse, what about you?
My story is very similar, except it was my father that introduced me to comic books. Little did I know that my father was a closet comic book fan. I only actually found out about this maybe about 3 years ago. My father in Mississippi used to buy comic books, and at some point in his life just stopped. So when he had a son, I can remember my father bringing me my first few comic books, which were Avengers and Fantastic Four. And one of the first comic books I ever got from my father was a copy of the Avengers with the Black Panther featured. So once again, just like John said, they created a monster, because once they introduced me to comic books, I never gave them up. I mean, still to this day, 50 years later, I still have my comic book digital subscriptions. And what really hits me about comic books is that they're modern day mythology. There are modern day morality tales. In the past, these type of stories used to be passed orally, from father to son, from mother to daughter. But we've taken our heroes and we've now put them in superhero tights and fantastic costumes, but they're still telling the same stories that we heard from John Henry, from Hercules, from Beowulf. It's those same morality tales, those same tales of honor and history and adventure that we're seeing. And it's great to see a whole new generation coming up reading the same tales that we did as we were growing up.
You know, I'm so deep in this world. I have a little 7-year-old boy who's deep, deep in this world. And I just marvel at him, marveling in all of his comic book heroes. For you two growing up as little Black boys, who were your comic book heroes, your favorites? And I know there are so many, so maybe if you can even think about the first two on your list. And I'll start with you, Jesse.
Oh, wow. There were so many that it's really hard for me to narrow it down just to two. I mean, obviously, I was a huge Avengers fan. And the issues I look forward to the most were when the Black Panther and the Falcon were guest starring in those issues, because they were the just about the only two characters that I really could relate to. Because when I was growing up, there weren't many characters of color. I mean, it's not that hard to name them all. You had Falcon, you had Black Panther, you had Black Lightning, you had Luke Cage. So I went looking for these heroes, and the books that they showed up in were the ones I gravitated to. But as I grew older, I also did just glom on to some of the big heroes. Even though I will tell you, still to this day, I am a huge Flash fan. So Mark Waid's run on the Flash was just incredible to me, because Wally West was growing up at the same time I was, and I followed him step by step.
What about you, John?
Oh, I have a similar role. It's so many stories. Oh my goodness. And just like Jesse was saying, I mean, you definitely have, like, you had your early Black characters. I noticed the Falcon, you know, pretty early, because he's, you know, Captain America's best friend and partner, right? And I was a big Captain America fan. And then I think the character that really, really kind of, like, I don't want to say politicized me, or made me really think about, like, representation a lot, was Monica Rambeau as Captain America.
Oh, yes.
You know, 1980 or so. But honestly, my favorite two superheroes were Marvel characters, and that was Daredevil and Spider-Man, right? And, you know, those, just like Jesse was saying about, like, relating to Wally West, you know, despite the race of the character, it was just like, I felt such a strong relationship to Daredevil. I just, you know, I was, you know, I came up, you know, a poor Black kid in Mississippi, and, you know, I was, you know, I was teased in school like Matt Murdock was, and I don't know, I just felt like his superpower wasn't his ability to do the things he could do with his senses and stuff. His superpower was the fact that he never stopped. Like, you absolutely have to kill Daredevil to stop him from accomplishing something, and I just liked his spirit, you know. And it was a certain issue of Frank Miller's run on Daredevil when he, quote unquote, fought the Hulk. And you might even know this issue. But the thing about it is that, you know, they call him the man without fear. And there's this one part where, you know, he's trying to stop the Hulk from destroying New York. And he's getting battered around like a fly. And Daredevil can hear the injuries happening to his body because, you know, he has these senses and stuff, too. And this is this one part where he's like, you know what? I can stop right now. Nobody would know but me, right? And it's one part where the Hulk has this wall about to drop it on him. And he was in the shadow of this wall. And for some reason in my little 11-year-old heart, I realized that that's what it meant to be Black in America right there in that one moment. And I just totally connected to that character on so many levels. And I forget the issue right now, but it's the thing that made me love that character so much, because he would get up. He would always get up, you know, after a fight. And what Jesse was saying about our mythology and about our heroes, I think that's right on the money, honestly, because the idea of, you know what, I have the ability to stop something from happening, even though I might lose my life or I might actually, like, have to sacrifice, you know. The Spider-Man mantra, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. That's like almost like a golden rule right there. So anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I love that character.
No, this is really great, because, I mean, what you're saying is the depth of character development is almost unparalleled to these stories. That's why they're so timeless.
And Tanya, let me add in here, because John brings up something that I remember being so angry about with Monica Rambeau. Monica Rambeau ends up as Captain Marvel, and she ends up being chairman of the Avengers. You have first Black chairman of the Avengers. At one point, she stands up to Zeus, the head of the pantheon of Greek gods. She's able to go toe-to-toe with one of the most powerful characters in the universe. Yet her time as Avengers chair ends because she has the blast of sea monster. And all of a sudden, she's not Avengers chair anymore. I'm still mad about that to this day.
Because yeah, it just upsets a lot of folks.
They promote her to the top, and then they move her out the way with what to me at that time seemed to be a ridiculous decision. Monica wow. Rambeau was representing us as the leader of the most powerful group of superheroes, and she loses that spot for what to me at that age was like a ridiculous decision. And she's never been chair of the Avengers again. And I've always felt that she was robbed. But you see how these stories just strike to your heart.
You begin to
relate to these characters. You begin to get mad for them. You get mad at them.
At them for them. Exactly. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, I love that character. And you know, like I said, I like Luke Cage and particularly Power Man and Iron Fist, you know, quite a bit. And then I was really into the Falcon, especially when I think it was Christopher Priest that wrote that miniseries. I was like, wow, it made me really love the Falcon even more. But yeah, when I saw Monica Rambeau, you know, and I love Captain Marvel and I love Miss Marvel and stuff. And for her, this wonderful, like, kind of remix of that costume. And then she had this regal, beautiful black, you know, just afro, you know.
This afro. Like,
the afro, I was like, that's when I felt it, because like my mom was rocking the afro at the time. I was like, yeah, I see it now, you know. Anyway, sorry.
And on top of everything else, let's just point out, she also was a Southerner. She was from New Orleans.
She was from New Orleans. That's right. Sorry. Yeah.
This is what I want to do. Okay, guys, this is what I want to do, because the magic is just so great between the two of you. So what I want to do, I just have two additional questions, and it's about your projects. And then I want you to talk with each other, to ask your respective questions of each other. And I have a few directions that way, but let's just do it so we can stop the torture and you guys can talk with each other. Okay. Jesse, Tales of Wakanda was your brainchild. You've got some of the best black writers out there to write new adventures for T'Challa and Killmonger and Shuri and other characters from the Black Panther world. I know John wants to ask you what it was like working with those authors to adapt a comic book, but what was it like? How much coaching did they need to get into the stories in the way that you and John are into the stories?
Well, that's the really strange thing about it. They didn't require any coaching at all. All of the writers that I approached for Tales of Wakanda were ready, willing, and just chomping at the bit to write their own individual stories about Wakanda.
Why do you think that was?
Well, because the Black Panther as a character is a character that touched all of us who were comic book fans. And we look at the people who went to the movie and are now all Black Panther. We're like, you know, you guys are about 20, 30 years too late. We knew how cool this character was a long time ago. And this character has touched so many people. But this character's been touching comic book readers of color and Afrofuturism readers of color for decades. So when I finished my first Black Panther novel and I was looking around and trying to decide what I wanted to do next for Black Panther, and I decided that, you know what? I would love to not only write a Black Panther story, but you know what? I want to read them. I want to see what other people would do with this character. So, frankly, I got on the phone and started calling some friends who called their friends. And then I happened to one day to be walking through the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and who happened to be sitting in the cafeteria was Nikki Giovanni. So I walk over to Nikki Giovanni and introduce myself and say, hey, you know what I'm doing right now? I am working on a Black Panther anthology. Do you have a Black Panther story you want to tell? And she was like, I would love to do that. And so, I mean, it was just so, it all came together just so easily. And I'm just so grateful that I got a chance to work with all of these great writers that I've been reading my entire life.
You hear me and John gasping and like, we're both like, what?
What?
John, the Megascope graphic novel are part of a wave of new work that's being called Afrofuturist work. You know, so many of us understand what that means, but can you explain that label and whether it describes what you're doing and what you're interested in and what you hope people see in your work?
Okay, I'll try to be as terse as possible because it's a big thing.
I know.
Afrofuturism is a term, a cultural production method that is coined in about 1994 by the cultural critic Mark Derry for a collection of essays called Flame Wars, which was about
cyberculture. And you know what, John? You don't have to get that deep because I have done segments on Afrofuturism and to tell people what it is. But like how you fit into this idea and this label, and do you think it fully describes and encapsulates?
Oh, okay. I was about to do a micro lecture.
I know you. Quick. I can tell.
Yeah, because I teach. All see I teach you coming, three, John. We can all. See
yeah,
you
no, it was like a mile away. You know, because I teach like three classes in Afrofuturism: one on aesthetics, one on horror, and one on superheroes. So it's like it's a huge. Yeah. So okay. Yes, it does fit what we're doing. I would like to use the statement that Lisa Yazyk, who's a colleague of mine, talks about with Afrofuturism. It's part of it is a reclamation of the history of the future. And what I mean by that is like when you think about like future narratives, like from the 1950s, you don't see people of color in them, you know. And so that's a type of violence. That's a type of erasure, right? There's a sociological term called symbolic annihilation. So basically, by not showing someone, you're decimating them. You're destroying hope. You're destroying like the fact that they existed, right? Afrofuturism, from a political standpoint, from a creative standpoint, is to reclaim that future and to talk about alternative realities, to talk about Black agency and subjectivity. So yes, Megascope basically came out of the success of the two Octavia Butler books that we had done, me and Damian Duffy, with Abrams Comic Arts. And, you know, the Megascope itself is a device that appears in a W.E.B. Du Bois short science fiction story that was found by Britt Russert and Adrian Brown, two professors who were going through his papers, and they had never seen this science fiction story before, because we already knew he wrote speculative fiction. But this was like straight up like geeky sci-fi story. And the Megascope is this device that he created that could look into different realities. And I thought it'd be a great name for a line of books. And so basically Megascope is looking at speculative fiction by and about people of color. And also we're looking at historical fiction and also crime fiction, because I love crime fiction. so did he too, because he wrote crime fiction too. But yeah, so yeah, in a nutshell, speculative fiction encompasses what could be considered Afrofuturism, the Afro-surreal, magical realism, what I call the ethnogothic, you know, horror, science fiction, all the different things that actually relate to something that supposedly doesn't exist in reality. So, and it's all graphic novels. Yeah.
What your work is really doing is, if what was happening was destroying hope, I mean, you are instilling hope in a new generation, the hearts and minds of readers who see themselves.
I mean, yes. I think that hope is definitely a huge part of it. Also, ways to deal with, you know, past trauma. Ways to think about, like, alternative realities, things that could have been and should have, you know. Basically, yeah, we want to focus on new voices, uncover older voices that should have gotten their due back in the day. Like Jesse was talking about with the Black Panther. It's like, yeah, of course the Black Panther's awesome. We've known it for a while. You know, how do we want to shed the light on people like, you know, like Charles Saunders, who just passed away, who did, you know, sword and sorcery stories, but, you know, from ancient Africa, you know. We want to do stories like that, you know, and the fact that Megascope, as a concept, was discovered like in one of the greatest scholars' papers, just sitting there for us to discover, I think it's just indicative of the type of stories we want to do.
Okay, now comes the fun part. I'm going to have you each ask each other 2 to 3 questions, and okay, I will step back and just be a fly on the wall for this.
Okay, that's awesome. So, did you want to go first, Jesse?
Sure, John, because the first question I have for you, John, comes up about something you just talked about, which is the adaptation of Octavia Butler's Kindred and Parable of the Sower, which I just so happen having sitting right here in front of me. What was it like to take one of the iconic books of Black speculative fiction and turn it from a novel into a graphic novel? Now, for those of you out there, I'm going to go all nerd on you. This is a graphic novel, not a collected edition. Collected editions right. are individual comic books that are just collected and put into one book. This is a graphic novel, which is one tale that's completely written for that genre. So
that's correct.
What was it like to do that?
First of all, it was really daunting. Thank you for supporting. Thank you for picking those up. Me and my friend and colleague Damian Duffy, Dr. Damian Duffy, were so honored to actually get a chance to do this for Abrams Comic Arts. And, you know, I won't get into how it came about, but more about the process. So the first thing is that, you know, we're a creative team. We're what they call a four-handed creator. Between the two of us, we can actually, like, start a project from start to finish, you know, from, like, ideation to laying it out. We have the skill set of like a baby publisher, like a tiny publisher. And that helped a lot because we've been working together for like 15 years. And so what ends up happening is Damian, who is the adapter, he actually had to take, you know, these perfectly chosen words by the grand dame of science fiction. And, you know, with her, with everybody watching, with her estate watching, with her agent watching and saying, okay, we're going to have to take this and translate it into another medium, right? Because comics are another medium. So that means figuring out like what timelines had to be put together. Because if you look at the original novel, there's parts where Dana, the main character who time travels back, you know, to slavery time in Maryland, where she talks about trips that she took, but weren't necessarily described that well, or we had to compress characters who actually could actually represent different aspects of it. That was a really difficult part of it as well, like just trying to figure out all the timelines. Then Damian, once he got a script edited down, I had to take that script, break it down into, you know, just an advanced reader's copy, like do like all the breakdowns for it. Then I had to go back and ink that, you know, with, you know, digitally ink it and then color it. And it was the largest project we'd ever done. I actually injured my shoulder drawing it because I wasn't, you know, I hurt my, yeah, because I was trying to lay out the book and also color it. So actually, this is the first time where I had to use like coloring assistants. And so I actually became project manager in the middle of it too, to actually like pull in these different coloring assistants. One of the things about it too is like, as you know, there's a jump between the present, which for us is the past, is 1976, to the 1800s. And so what we did, a lot of times when you're doing things with flashbacks, you make the flashback either washed out or you might use a sepia tone or something like that. But in the book, Octavia Butler talks about how the more that she traveled back, the more vivid it became, right? And so we liked that idea. And the other thing was that her and her husband, who's a white man, you know, moving into this new house in Southern California, they hadn't made any memories in that house yet. So it's not home for them yet, right? So one of the most terrifying aspects of that book is the fact that the more that she traveled back to the past, the more comfortable it became. So we actually decided to make it very colorful. We went full color with that. And then for the sepia tone, we actually more so used more of a maroon color. I actually sampled the colors of like wounds and like bruises, actually, to make that color that you're seeing. So it's almost like a, it's almost like, you know, like caked over blood, because a lot of the story is about blood kinships, you know, between, you know, the slaves and the slave owners, and also how the wounds of slavery have not healed yet. So color actually was a huge part of it. But yeah, but it was arduous. It took us a while to get it together. I actually physically went to, you know, slave museums and plantations to kind of get like, you know, like the one that's in New Orleans, for instance, the one where there was where Quentin Tarantino filmed Django Unchained, you know, is near that area, actually. Yeah, and so me and my wife went and we were looking at these different spaces, taking pictures. There was a lot of research as far as like how the characters were created. It just took a team of us to get it done, you know. And at the end of the day, we were just really, really grateful that people actually what we were trying to do is, like, we didn't want people to hate it. You know, that's the first thing. Because if you think Beyonce fans are bad.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. You're talking about, like, the Butler Mavens or Butler Peak folk. It was very difficult. And also, too, and this is a Black woman story, right?
Right.
With a Black protagonist. And, you know, you have two cisgender hetero men, one of which is white. Damien's actually a white writer who does really great work with characters of color, which is one of the things we, you know, connect over. The audacity of taking a classic book like that and doing it was a lot of pressure. Yeah. So I don't know. I could go on, but that's how it was. It was difficult. But essentially the thing is that you have to take prose, and sometimes you have to show and not tell. You have to pull back, because when you sign a contract to do a graphic novel, the page number is in your contract. So you got to hit that number. And so you only have so many pages where you can actually, like, tell this really sweeping story. So there was a lot of editing that had to happen. Sheila Keenan, our editor, really should have had her name on the front cover too, because she helped us make those hard cuts, you know. I will say that it was harrowing, because there's a scene in Kindred, the whipping scene in the second chapter, which is called The Fire, where the description of it is so powerful that I literally was weeping onto original artwork, you know, because and so with something that effective, you know, you re-traumatize yourself every time you sketch it, then you ink it, then you color it. You're making it more and more reified, you know. So that would be my answer for that. So, and it was long answer.
I can really believe you, because I had that same feeling when I was watching the first episode of Watchmen on HBO.
Yeah.
I couldn't make it through it, because it was just re-traumatizing you all over again. And I can see exactly what you're talking about with that chapter.
Well, yeah. And it's the thing is that it's a horror story. You know, I was the first African-American man to win the Bram Stoker Award for that graphic novel, actually, which is like the Oscars of horror, right? And
right.
And so because once you realize, see, this is a difficult thing, too. And I'm sure we're getting to this about, like, because my question is about how do you take a comic book and do the opposite? because it's so different. Like, the media is so different. And, so what happened was, if you read the original novel, right, you don't realize that Dana is Black until the second chapter, which is almost 40 pages into the book, right? That's something that we couldn't rely on. And this is something Damien talks about a lot. As a writer, you know what I'm saying, to get the stakes of the story and also the realization of what's really, really happening in that 1 second, you can't do that with the graphic novel. We lost that because obviously she's a Black woman, because, you know, because we're using pictures, right? But you don't know that until Rufus drops the N-word in the second, chapter. And you're like, whoop. Horror story. You got to get out of this.
Right.
You're in slip. You got to go now. Anyway, I'm sorry. It's just a really powerful moment in the story. So, Jesse, so how is it taking a seminal canon, you know, piece like Who is the Black Panther by Reginald Hudlin and John Romita Jr., and then transposing it into prose? Like, what was that process like?
Oh, that was just incredibly stressful, like you were talking about, because Reginald Hudlin is a friend of mine. He's, oh, in wow. fact, just a couple of seconds ago, we were chatting on Facebook. so to have the person whose story you're adapting as part of your life, as someone you look up to, as someone you hope to one day to be one of your mentors, I was really worried about what he would think about what I was doing, because his first run on Black Panther was issues 1 through 6. It's 6 issues of a 32-page comic book. I now have to take those 6 issues and turn them into 90,000 words. which means that I'm going to have to add to the story.
That's right.
I'm going to have to put some of my own spin on it. And frankly, I was afraid that Reginald would be insulted, that I was taking his story and making some changes to it. But he was very encouraging to me the entire process. When I went to him and said, hey, you know, they're asking me to do this. I basically want your blessing to take your story and make some changes to it, because comic books are a completely different medium from novels. So you're going to have to add in things that people are seeing in the comic book, but I don't have the art to show in a novel. So I'm going to have to describe things. I'm going to have to get into more of a thought process of what the characters are thinking. So I basically took the comic books and went back through and made a very detailed outline of every single thing that I could see in the comic books, not just the words, but what I could also see, and try to figure out how to translate that into a novel. And what also made it a little different is that when I agreed to do this, they wanted this novel set in what was then modern times, which was 2018. But when Reginald Hudlin wrote it, it was back during the George W. Bush administration. So we've skipped from the Bush administration all the way to the Trump administration, which is a completely different world. So I'm having to take some of these characters and give them different missions in life, because what they were doing back then wasn't what they would be doing now. But it ended up working out really well. I think that my version of T'Challa is slightly different from the one that Reginald Hudlin wrote. So if you've read the comic book, the first six issues of Reginald Hudlin's run, my Black Panther, my T'Challa, my Shuri, my Ramonda, my Dora Mihaly warriors, they're all slightly different. They're modernized, and they've moved a little further down the timeline. They do different things, but I fell in love with these characters. So when I got a chance to do Tales of Wakanda, I didn't want to just bring other writers and read their versions. I want to give my characters another chance to live as well. So you see the same T'Challa that I sweated over in the first novel. He reappears in Tales of Wakanda. It's the exact same universe. And I was grateful to give these characters such another shot at the spotlight, because after you work on a character for so long, you begin to talk to them. They begin to, even worse, they begin to talk back. They begin to tell you as an author, you know, I wouldn't do that. No. That's not what I would say. I would say this. And sometimes it's really weird. You'll be sitting there at your computer and you're not even thinking about what you're writing, because the characters are writing themselves. You've gotten such a connection with them. And it became almost weird for me to read other people's versions of the Black Panther, because my T'Challa says that he would do this, but in this story, he's doing that. So I especially when I started working with other authors on Black Panther in this anthology, I had to remember they're not writing my T'Challa. They're writing their T'Challa. They're not writing my Shuri. They're writing their Shuri. You get so deep into what these characters would do, you sometimes forget they're not really real. They're only real to you. So
I love that. Yeah, I talked about that all the time, where people are like, well, how do you start writing a story? And I was like, well, or how do you keep your story straight in your head is one of the main questions that people ask me. And I was like, well, how do you keep your family straight in your head, or your friends straight in your head, right? They're like your friends. So it's like, you know, it's like, well, how do you not mix up your best friend with this guy you just met the other day kind of thing, right? It's they tell you what they you know, what they need from you. You know, if you build them correctly, right? Yeah, no, I love that. And so it just feels good to be like, you know, I love the fact that you said that, because I say the same thing.
My next question is: I got a chance in Tales of Wakanda to work with a bunch of great writers. Mm-hmm. But with Megascope, you're not just working with writers. You're working with artists. You're working with everyone across the creative genre, everyone. How do you keep, how do you direct and make sure you're getting the right person for the right thing at the right time?
You know, I've been really fortunate. I've actually had a chance to do a lot of curatorial work. You know, I have a design background and a book design background, and taught design history. And I have to understand, like, as a cartoonist, that when you are making a design for a character, every aspect of a comic book can communicate. You know, from the borders to the gutters to the typeface that you use, everything is used for the storytelling mechanism. And it's this very surreal medium. The way that someone makes a line is almost like a dialect, right? Like, for instance, if you see Dennis Cowan's hand, you can see almost all of the different dialects that he's speaking, because you can read an artist's inspirations in the way that they handle the pen, right? And so what I try to do is think about, like, the affect that an artist is bringing to the table and match it with the story and try to understand, you know, what the heart of the story is, and then how that particular artist is either going to accent it or actually push back against it too. Like, there's a couple of books where we chose artists whose style didn't exactly fit the tone of the book, and you get this kind of dissonance that actually resonates in the story too. So it's really like an archival, like a DJ process. And also too, a lot of my research is in hip hop too. So I think like a DJ sometimes, who, or what I call a CJ, you kind of sampling and remixing the things that you see. Yeah. Cause I used to teach, like, about hip hop culture, bricolage, and how it relates to, you know, curation and stuff. So that's my relatively quick answer. You could tell I'm a professor. I'd be professing, Lord have mercy, anyway. my final question to you, Jesse, was, I'm a Southern Black man, you know, coming out into this space, dealing with media. My question was, how does, you know, being a Southern Black man, like, change or filter through the work that you do? Like, how do you use it as an epistemology, or do you use it as an epistemology? And how does it shift the filter, you know, that you apply to your work? You know, just curious about that.
One of the things that I talk about always when I'm teaching, I'm a professor of journalism, and I'm also a professor of creative nonfiction. And one of the things I tell all of my writers is that you write what you know. So when you're reading something that you're picking up from me, you're getting part of my life experience in that story, whether it's fiction, whether it's nonfiction, and especially when you start talking about stories around the Black Panther. One of the things that I made sure of when I put together the author list and the story list of the stories I wanted to see in this anthology was that there would be representation of Southerners. And I can tell you now that there's one of the stories that is set in the book. It's set in Mississippi. Another one is set in New Orleans. Another one is set in South Carolina, because those are places I know. And I can read those stories, and I know the blocks that they're talking about. I know the Mississippi Delta. I know New Orleans. And so those were part of what I wanted to see represented in the book. One of the soapboxes I always get on is that we don't have enough stories about rural African-Americans in the South. For some reason, every time we talk about African-Americans, we talk about urban. But there were so many of us who grew up in the South. And not only in the South, the rural South, and we don't have enough of those stories. So I made sure that some of those stories revolving around the Black Panther, would revolving around Shuri, would show up in this anthology, because I think there's a whole year's worth of stories ready to be told. And when I wrote my story for Black Panther, it touched on an issue that is huge in my life, and that is faith and religion, where I have T'Challa have to confront his own religion. Why does he believe in it? That's something that a lot of us talk about. So I tell people, when you're reading a story, the writer isn't only telling you the story, they're also telling you about themselves. When you read anything that I write, you're not only reading a tale of T'Challa, you're also reading the tale of Jesse J. Holland. I'm just using T'Challa to tell my story. And I think that's what makes literature memorable. You can just write a story that will be entertaining, but when you can also explain not only about yourself, but explain life, that's what makes stories memorable. And so I tell people to put part of themselves in everything they do, and you can definitely find parts of me in all of my work.
I love it.
Okay, so John, how much of yourself do you pour into your work? A lot of times you can see the author, the artist in their work. Can you see yourself in your work?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yes, I definitely can see myself in my work. It's something that I... like yourself, wear like a badge of honor. I often say that, you know, you're not necessarily from Mississippi. You survived Mississippi. Sometimes I think of it like that. I was thinking about what you were saying about the notion of like representation. When I start thinking about Afrofuturism, for instance, right, I have made it a point to point out to people that a lot of the top folk who are in this kind of Afrofuturist mindset are either connected to the South or from the South, right? Sun Ra was from the South, actually. So was George Clinton originally. So was people like, Maurice White, who's connected to, you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire. I look at Dr. King as an Afrofuturist because he was a lot of this thing is about like aspiration. You know, it's something that's connected to speculation. And I've made it a point in my teaching and in my work and my work ethic is to think about the fact that when we think about a Southern space, we for a long time have connected that to trauma, to like the past and to like backwardness and things like that. But that's quite the opposite. I mean, technically, you know, a lot of the Black Panther film was filmed in the South, right? In Atlanta.
Right. So that's, in Atlanta.
Atlanta is. And honestly, a lot of these towns, you know, like Tulsa and other spaces, I mean, those were our Wakandas, you know, before, you know, oppressive, you know, violence happened in those spaces. So much about me and about the work that I do is about reclaiming, you know, those types of spaces. That's why I created this thing called the Cyber Trap, which is looking at like future cyberpunk that's set in the South. So I actually created like a whole like new Mississippi that's set far flung in the future, right? That is actually one of the most technologically advanced spaces in the future, because a lot of times, you know, the future South is like erased. Most of the sci-fi that's happening is happening in like New York and Chicago, places like that. And I often contest like our ancestors that actually traveled, you know, up to Chicago and these other spaces, those were some of the first Afrofuturists, because they were like, you know what, I can actually create a better space in these other places. So a lot of that culture and a lot of those ideas I carry with me in my work. You look at some of the images that I do that have this kind of turquoise color in it. That's a color called Haint Blue that's actually comes out of South Carolina.
Yes.
Yeah, because basically, yeah, it's a Haint Blue color. Like I grew up in a Haint Blue house in the country. You know, I understand. You know, my grandmother probably was a root worker, so I become really, kind of fascinated by, you know, hoodoo culture and conjure culture of late. And also, my mother was a quilt maker, and so when I think about the things I want to do with my work, like as a pastiche or like the ideas around Megascope, I'm just making a giant quilt. Just a beautiful quilt, you know? And that's why I think like the aesthetics of the South and aesthetics of being a African-American man in this space affect how I move and how I make the work.
Wow. I'm about to say, I can't say it better than that. So John, it's been great talking to you.
Have a wonderful weekend, brother. And I look forward to further conversations with you.
That was John Jennings, founder and director of the new line of graphic novels by and for people of color called Megascope, and Jesse Holland, editor of Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda, and the story of the Holland family farm in Mississippi told in Represent, part of the DC Comics Heritage Series. You can check out more of their work on our website, hereandnow.org. And you can catch Here and Now every weekday on hundreds of NPR member stations around the country. And you can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This special episode was produced by Lynn Minigon and Mike Moschetto. I'm Tanya Mosley, and thanks for listening.